For the week of June 1st, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 238, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the state park in Tennessee that is the home of Davy Crockett's birthplace, I'm Michael Giltz. Picture me in a coonskin cap.
Wow. Okay. Just a coonskin cap, or should we?
Well, no. For all your safety, I suggest you picture me in clothes, perhaps fringy buckskin pioneer stuff, and a coonskin cap. Davy Crockett, a little tribute to him.
Okay. Well, didn't the Brady Bunch feature an episode wherein one of the young boy characters played Davy Crockett or had a coonskin cap?
I think you're stretching it, and you just want to get to the fact that Ambie Davis, who played Alice, died this week.
Yes. Well, I didn't want to really get to that fact, but unfortunately, yes, she passed away. She was the housekeeper on The Brady Bunch.
That's right. And it's funny how some of these things punch through the pop culture noise. That was something that a lot of people mentioned to me. I mean, it's a silly show. It still sticks in American pop culture. I wonder how well it's known around the world. I'm sure it's known a bit. I'm sure the show played all over the world, but Ambie Davis, Alice is dead. That really strikes a chord with people, certainly of the generation that watched the show especially, but she had sort of an interesting career. She won two Emmys playing a secretary in the Bob Cummings Show, and that's kind of cool because the Bob Cummings Show is the first show in TV history to be a mid-season replacement.
And I guess that was in the 1950s.
That's right. And she never married. Alice, of course, had the butcher Sam, but she certainly fit a stereotype of a certain type of single gal, a confirmed bachelorette. And in fact, in real life, she never married. I'm not sure what the deal was with her personal life, but she was a committed Episcopalian. She joined like an Episcopalian community and moved with them when they moved to Pennsylvania. So that was a big part of her life, especially after the Brady Bunch and all her earlier success on TV started to slowly fade away.
Well, you know, Ambie Davis's character on the Bob Cummings Show was Schultzy, which was, believe it or not, an inspiration for the comic book character Pepper Potts. And of course, we all know Pepper Potts. She is a supporting character in the Iron Man comics and now, of course, the movies. And so that's a little piece of trivia for you on Ambie Davis, who passed away at the age of 88 over the weekend.
So Ambie, from Ambie Davis to Gwyneth Paltrow, quite the transformation for Schultzy.
Yes, exactly.
So what do we talk about this week on the show other than the great Ambie Davis?
Well, and I would like to know whether the Brady Bunch was popular overseas. And so any of our overseas listeners, please let us know. You can call us. 888-567-SAND is our voicemail number. You can call us again at 888-567-7263. Or you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. But you asked about today's show, Michael. And we've got so much to cover on today's show, I'm not even sure where to begin. I guess maybe I'll start at the end, because during Inside Baseball, we're going to be joined by film journalist and critic Anthony Kaufman to discuss his excellent piece for IndieWire about how foreign language films are languishing at the U.S. box office. Now, Michael, you're just back from this year's Book Expo, and I guess you're going to fill us in on everything going on in the publishing world. And since the Tony Awards are next Sunday, we're going to talk a little bit about that, who's performing and what to expect in the world of, I guess, awarding Broadway's best and brightest for this year. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about the weekend box office around the world. This is according to Rent Track and other stories that appear in The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, The LA Times, and elsewhere. We piece it all together. But Rent Track is our main source. We've got a link to their website in our show notes. And the number one movie around the world, out of nowhere, frankly, is Maleficent, the Angelina Jolie film that grossed $100 million.
What do you mean out of nowhere? This is a movie that has been in the works for about 3 years. They spent $200 million making this movie and promoting the heck out of it. When you say out of nowhere...
Angelina Jolie, I feel like her career has been sort of on the back burner. She's had a couple flops in a row, not counting the animated films. She had The Tourist and Salt and Changeling. Wanted did well. That's probably her last hit. That was 6 years ago. And then before that, there weren't a lot of big movies until you get back to Mr. and Mrs. Smith with her and Brad Pitt. So I felt like her career felt like it was simmering. You know, she's moving towards directing, working on that. She's got a big directorial film this fall. But I think, why suddenly a remake of Sleeping Beauty would become the biggest opening weekend of her career? It just struck me as a bit of a surprise.
Well, it's not really a remake. It's kind of like
it's a new spin on Sleeping Beauty. I mean, it's another telling of the tale.
Yes.
That's right. So it made $170 million worldwide, and this is what I love. We actually got some 3D figures on it. Maleficent hit 21% of its gross in North America came from 3D screens. 21%.
Wow. I saw it in 3D.
Why even bother?
I saw it in 3D, and the reason I did that is because, of course, the director is formerly a visual effects phenomenon, and it was very good 3D, actually. It was quite well done.
I'm sure it was fine, but did you think, oh my God, you have to see this film in 3D? It adds such a wonderful dimension to it. It's just not the same in 2D. Oh my gosh, I love 3D.
I think that, that last bit there, I don't know about. But certainly the 3D did add to it in this particular movie because of the fantastical nature of it. So it's very Avatar-like in that regard. Would it have been the same in 2D? Maybe not, but it certainly would. I don't think necessarily would have been horrible in 2D.
But the other point is it got poor reviews. It's gotten very mixed to poor reviews. So,
and I don't see where the poor reviews are coming from. It's a fine, film. It's not, the greatest movie ever made. It lags in parts, but narratively, but it's fine.
Fine. Well, fine is hardly a ringing endorsement.
Well,
so that
true.
Is the number one movie around the world in 3D or 2D or 1D, however, no matter how you're seeing it, that's the number one film. And number two around the world is X-Men Days of Future Past, another $128 million. It hits $500 million worldwide. It's the top grossing X-Men film in the entire franchise. That's the good news.
Adjusted for inflation? No, just kidding.
No, but probably because they don't go that far back into the past. But let me tell you, that's the good news. Do you want to hear the bad news?
What's the bad news?
Well, you only need to gross another $100 million, just break even.
Oh,
they spent so much money to make it and to market it. That's nice that it hit $500 million, but it better hit $600 million if you want to call this a financial success.
Well, don't you think it will hit? It's definitely going to hit $600 million.
Yes, I do, but I'm just putting it into perspective. When you pay $200 million to make a movie and then a lot more to market it, not a lot more than $200 million, but a lot to market it, you're going to need to make $700 million just to break even. So, sure, it's the biggest grossing one in the franchise. It also costs the most and it hasn't made a profit yet.
Well, given that the, premium cable and pay TV and all of those licensing fees are portions or percentages of the theatrical box office gross domestically, they're doing pretty good.
Well, it's always good to hit profitability at the theater. You don't want to have to make it up on DVD and video on demand and cable.
Right.
So you want that to be the gravy. And number three around the world is, what is it called?
A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Suddenly I wanted to say 8 million ways to die in the West. That's probably 7 million too many. A million ways to die in the West.
Well, $7 million too many, that's for sure.
It's the Seth MacFarlane Western comedy trying to be this era's Blazing Saddles. It made $27 million around the world. Pretty good start overseas in 22 territories overall. It's considered a bit of a flop. It opened, third or fourth in America? It opened third in North America. But I think it only cost like $40 million to make. So it's nowhere near the steamroller that Ted was, his last big feature film. But on the other hand, he didn't star in that one, did he? I don't know why he decided to star in this.
Yeah, well, he did star in it, but he actually portrayed a foul-mouthed stuffed teddy bear, if you recall.
Right. I mean, he didn't appear as an actor in Ted.
Correct. And I completely agree with you. I don't know why he felt the need to star in this film. He could have had anybody else do this role.
And it probably would have helped. And he's not exactly a terrific actor.
No.
But number four around the world is Godzilla, another $27 million. It's slowing down pretty quick. We'll have to see where it ends up. It's at $375 million worldwide. The Tom Cruise film opened up overseas in some territories, not very strongly either. It's called Edge of Tomorrow. Its co-stars Emily Blunt, is that right?
That's right. And look, 28 territories, right? And you get $20 million? I would agree with you. It's a soft opening for Mr. Cruise.
But it's getting good reviews, so this one could have legs. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Well, remember, Doug Liman directed this movie, and he is a fantastic director.
Well, fantastic is a little strong, but yeah, he's a very good director. He's made some very good films. And number six is Overheard 3. This is a Hong Kong crime thriller. It made just about $20 million. I love this movie. This movie stars the same guys who starred in Overheard 2, but they play different characters. And they also starred in Overheard 1, but they played different characters in that. So they made this crime thriller, Overheard, in which, and I'm sure it will be remade, cops are listening on bad guys, and they get a stock tip, an illegal stock tip, and they decide to act on it, and they make like millions of dollars on the stock market illegally, And then the bad guys figure out it's them and they're trying to track him down and they can't tell their bosses because, you know, they broke the law, made millions of dollars off the stock market. So it's like them versus the bad guys. It's a showdown, mano a mano, with no, you know, support system from the police force. And I love it. A lot of people die at the end. So they're like, but we want a sequel. So they did. They just did it again, but with different characters. But the same guys. I love that.
I like it. I like it a lot. It's an instant green light. What else do you got?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think it's very a fascinating approach to a film series like that where, oh, you know, they're always going to live because they're going to go on to make the next movie. Well, not necessarily. And number seven is Neighbors, another $15 million. That's a big success given how little it costs to make. Over $200 million worldwide. And number eight on the opposite spectrum is the Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore comedy Blended that made $8 million, and it's at $30 million worldwide. Basically, it's only playing in North America. I'm sure it'll go out overseas.
My youngest daughter saw a poster for Blended at the shopping center the other day, and mm-hmm. she said, oh, I know that movie. And I said, wait, you do? And she said, oh, yes, yes. It ends in romance. which is anything that has any movie that has kissing, it's romance. So she said it ends in romance.
Oh, as long as she doesn't see the poster for Sin City. But we'll get to that later.
Ooh.
At number nine is The Amazing Spider-Man 2, also just about $8 million. It's at $690 million worldwide, and it's going to hit $700 million, obviously, any day now. Number 10 is Frozen, another $5 million. It keeps going. And number 11, another new film, A Hard Day. This is a South Korean thriller. It made about $5 million. And number 12 is that French comedy we've been talking about. Oh, what did we do to God? Or what did God do to us? It's made $77 million in France alone. That is a lot of money.
That is an extraordinary. Think about it. Think about how much money that is in France. And I'm not saying, oh, gee, in France, $77 million could buy you the whole country. What I'm saying is to earn $77 million U.S. dollars in one country with the population, I guess, what is it, 30 or 60 million, between 30 and 60 million?
Well, that's a big range.
Well,
is
I know. It's 50.
Is it 20 million or 40 million?
I don't know, but it's very difficult to make that much money in one single international territory.
That isn't China. Yeah, that exactly. Isn't China or perhaps India. I skipped over A Hard Day, which is the South Korean thriller, and it's about a cop who's going to his mother's funeral. He's just become a detective, I should say, I believe. He goes to his mom's funeral and he hits and runs and kills somebody. Oops. But he doesn't want to risk his new promotion. So he tries to cover up the crime. I'm sure everything will turn out just great.
Wait, is it a comedy where hijinks ensue?
It's a cop thriller. He says, I saw what you did last night. I saw what you did last summer at that funeral. And, you know, someone tries to blackmail him and it becomes very tense. France, by the way, has 66 million people.
Exactly. I was going to say that.
Oh, well, there you go. So that's Cop. And then down below towards the bottom is, I've never heard of this series, but it's called Happy Little Submarines. And this is Happy Little Submarines 4, The Adventures of Octopus. It's a Chinese animated film. I think it's spun off from a TV series, but I can't swear to that. And it made about $3 million, right ahead of the Zhang Yimou film Coming Home, the very serious Chinese drama starring the world's most beautiful woman, Gong Li.
Okay, and she's still the world's most beautiful woman to you.
She's a very attractive woman, absolutely.
Okay, well,
And there was a, you know, we mentioned Adam Sandler in Blended, which ends in romance. I guess he kisses Drew Barrymore, but he had a great quote in Variety. They were quoting him talking on a podcast, I think, Norm McDonald's. And he said, hey, why don't you go back to SNL? And Adam Sandler said, why should I? You know, like, what's the point? I did it already. You know, what's the point? Why? I'm like, well, your movie didn't open. Maybe that's a good reason to go back on SNL. Maybe get some attention and let people know you're still there.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's also richer than, you know, most comedians in the business.
Right, but you make a movie. If you want it to work, you know, why not go on SNL? But which brings up the fact, which I didn't know if it's even true, they implied that he was fired from the show. Fired?
Yeah.
Like, not brought back? Really?
I don't know about that.
Well, that's the implication. It was on Variety.
Okay. I
didn't know that. I mean, you know, fire, like he left in the middle of the day. They just didn't bring him back the following season or whatever. But it wasn't the same as saying, oh, he moved on. It was like, no, they didn't bring him back. Who knew?
Yeah, I certainly didn't. I just figured that he got too popular and was doing too many movies and, you know, didn't have time for SNL anymore. And he'd done it for so long.
Yeah, he did a long time. It was hardly a thing. So that's why I was even more surprised to hear about it happening that way.
Exactly. Well, now you are on the road. You're in Tennessee, literally at a state park, but
to be honest, I'm at a Wendy's and I'm stealing the Wi-Fi, but I'm near the Davy Crockett birthplace state park, and I could be wearing a coonskin cap. And if I am, I will auction it off to charity when the show is over.
Okay, well, yeah, I was going to say you just ruined the whole coonskin cap thing, but you know, you were also just getting back from Book Expo of America, or as I like to call it, BEA, and I think that is how it's referred to, right? And or is it the Expo?
No, the BEA a lot. Yeah, the Book Expo, the BEA, absolutely. And well, I didn't get back from it. It was in New York City. It's held there every year at the Javits Center, the gorgeous, lovely Javits Center on the far west side of Manhattan, right near Daisy Mary's, where I like to go eat barbecue. And it's a huge annual event, the biggest gathering, thousands of publishers, tons of back people who will distribute your books and ship them, people who will help you create an ebook, people to help you, you know, reach your audience on social media. There's agents, there's publishers, there's authors, there's book signings. It's very exciting.
And I guess the barbecue was so bad this year that you raced off to Nashville.
No, the barbecue at Daisy Mays is always good, but I'm heading down south to Birmingham ultimately to visit my family.
Ah, okay. I was just, trying to catch up there. Well, okay, so Book Expo of America, what is going on in the world of publishing, or dare I ask, or should I just call Amazon and find out?
Well, certainly the couple of really big things dominating the expo were Amazon versus Hachette, which we'll get to in a minute. And also, all these companies trying to become the Netflix for books, if that's the right comparison, try to become a subscription service where people pay a monthly fee to access books, a big library of books that they can read as much as they want. There's all sorts of models out there.
Well, we've talked about Oyster, right? We've talked about
Oyster
them.
Is one of them. Right. They're a big one. And Librify just made a deal with Target. And their idea is that what you really want, what America really needs, is a book club and social media stuff. So they work with Target to pick a book of the month. And then if you're a member of Librify, you can read that book and then you can share your notes and your comments and your thoughts and ideas. And they make that social media part of a book club, even though you're not in the same space, they make it a lot easier. So they think that's the key to getting people to sign up for a subscription service. Another company, what were they called? They launched in Russia and Turkey, and they kept sending me emails saying, hey, we're at Book Expo, cover us, write about us.
I think they call that BitTorrent, actually, is the company.
No. And so this is a book subscription service. You pay $5 a month and you access their library of books. So I went to their site to see, well, what books do you got? And I looked at their site, and it's all public domain books. I'm like, they're all like Huckleberry Finn and The Wizard of Oz and Moby Dick. And I'm like, do you have any books that aren't public domain that we can already get for free, you know, like on any device we want? He said, well, we're going to add more down the road. I'm like, well, call me when you actually get some books and you're, you know, like, why would you go and launch your thing and make attention when you have no books that people would conceivably want to pay for?
Yeah. Well, isn't that the way a lot of these things get started?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of startups. Most startups fail, of course, just like most businesses, most restaurants, most everything fails. But you would think they'd at least try to lead with their best foot forward. But I would say overall, they've really turned a corner. I think in the last few years, there was just a lot of fear and confusion about digital, and it still creates a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of change, a lot of churn. People are scrambling this way and that to figure out what to do. But I think now it's more that people are aggressive and coming up with new ideas and tackling a lot of different things. People aren't just, they don't have that blinded deer in a headlight look. They're actually going out there and doing stuff.
So they're being proactive about it. In years past, when you showed up, there were people going, oh, this is going to be the last BEA because heaven only knows we're all going to be fired next year because everybody's going to be stealing books or not buying books or we're dead in the water. But now what you're saying is, hey, no, they're actually, they're beginning to be proactive about it. They're beginning to come up with new business models and new ways to make money from publishing and from books. And they're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
I don't know if they're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, but they're seeing some light. So maybe they know where they are in the dark and they can see the tunnel better.
Okay.
Certainly, they've been better about digital. They saw the mistakes that happened in movies and music, and they were smarter. They did not wait until people were already stealing tons of books. As soon as Amazon had a decent e-reader, they were all there making their books available. So they've been very proactive about that. Romance. You may not think of romance as being a very forward-thinking genre.
No, when I think of romance, I think of usually like Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore.
And Drew Barrymore making out in Africa? Is that where they go?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So romance genre is, of course, very traditional in your mind. But in fact, they've always been very forward-thinking and very proactive in reaching out to their fans. They, of course, were big, heavy early in ebook, and now they're facing the next wave where so many self-published authors are ebook. So that's hurting the industry, but it's helping the authors and the fans. But they've always had conventions and reached out to fans and been strong on social media and doing stuff like Skype tours where they'll go and meet at your book club. Yeah. You can just meet the author and have her Skype into your book club and chat with you guys about her latest romance novel. So they've really been active. And I met with a number of romance publicists and people, and they were way on top of the ball about all the sort of stuff going on and the things that they do. Other people are playing catch up to what they've been innovating.
I love the fact that there's romance publicists.
Of course. Well, there's every genre in the world.
I know, but it just sounds odd, you know, when you put it that way.
Well, you know, that... never mind. I don't know. I picture them dressed up like a Harlequin romance cover, but no, that's not the case. But of course, the big discussion dominating was Hachette versus Amazon, which is really Amazon versus the world as far as everyone in publishing is concerned.
Well, and let's kind of catch some of our listeners up in case they may have missed. Hachette is a big publishing house, one of the big three. And
one of the big five.
Okay, fine. You're going to throw an extra two in? Fine. Yeah. It's one of the big five. And then you have, on the other side, you've got Amazon, which isn't a monopoly, as many listeners reminded me and reminded us, since I called it a monopoly last week. I was saying that they were acting in a monopoly-esque fashion. I realize they're not a monopoly. But
they have like 67% of all book sales, including print now.
So
in North America, I don't know how much of the whole business you need to own, but when you've got three times what anybody else has, you're getting close.
Yeah, well, and so I guess Amazon and Hachette are doing battle. Amazon is saying, look, you want to buy a Hachette book? Yeah, it might take you like 4 weeks, 3 weeks to get there. And no, you can't pre-order any of them. And oh, we're out of some Hachette books.
Well, to be clear, it's sort of like the cable fight. When CBS and Time Warner or Comcast, which was it?
It was Time Warner, and we're talking about in cable, it's retransmission consent disputes.
But whatever the argument is, they're having a contract dispute and trying to come up to new terms, who gets how much money. That's all it's about is money.
Right.
And while they're fighting, they took CBS off their cable station channel. So you couldn't see CBS in LA. This is the same thing happening here. They're fighting and arguing over money, who gets more, who gets how much. And while they're doing that, they are messing around with the Hachette books. They're saying, well, we're not going to promote your books. We're not going to give big discounts on your books. We're not going to feature them and put buy buttons or let people pre-order them. So we don't care that there's a new J.K. Rowling book. We don't care that there's a new James Patterson book coming out. We're not going to promote them on our site until we come to new terms. So they're playing hardball.
Right. And a part of this is that the agency pricing freeze, if you will, because there was that whole, antitrust or collusion claim, and all of these publishers agreed not to do agency pricing, where they basically say, we are going to price the book as the publisher, and we are going to give it to different sellers. So we're going to give it to Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and they're going to sell it at the price we determine, and they then get to keep a percentage of that price. Well, Amazon says, no. We want to be able to price the book because what we'd like to do is actually price it below what we're paying for it to drive others out of business.
They don't say that, of course, but that's what they're doing.
Right. Effectively, they're trying to drive Barnes & Noble out of business because, of course, they can't do that. They can't sell a book for less than it costs to purchase.
Well, they did and have, and that's why their digital division was bleeding hundreds of millions of dollars. Every time they sold a book, and they were very successful early on, they lost money. And the more books they sold, the more money they lost, and it became a nightmare for them.
Right. And effectively, Walmart got in trouble for doing this with pharmaceuticals and cosmetics, and now Amazon is...
Well, more to the point, it's, you know, that's why there are no record stores left in America, no big chains, because they were driven out of business by the big box stores like Best Buy and Walmart and Kmart and others, who would sell albums at a discount and get you to come into the store and maybe buy a dishwasher.
Right.
And that drove all the record store chains out of business. Same thing with DVDs. For a while, they sold and promoted DVDs and Blu-rays. And then when they got bored with it, they moved on to something else because they don't care what they sell. So you have thousands of independent bookstores and some major chains all supporting books. And you have Amazon on the other side, whose DNA is books in a way. But they, frankly, you know, they just need to make more money. They want more money. They've always been on razor-thin margins. And they want to get a bigger cut of the pie of the money that, you know, publishers are making off books. And if they don't get that, they're going to make life difficult for you. Because you know what? They can sell razor blades. They can sell other things and nobody will notice.
Right. And they figure if you're coming there for a book, Well, you'll probably stick around and buy something else, too.
Well, that's the Amazon Prime. So there were a lot of stories about this, a lot of talk. Every panel probably covered it. And there was an interview in the New York Times, I believe, with Malcolm Gladwell. Isn't that right?
I believe it was the New York Times, yes. And so what did you want to highlight in this particular
Well, they've got a new beat reporter covering publishing. His name is David Streitfeld, and he interviewed Malcolm Gladwell. And I don't know whether Gladwell was being disingenuous or clueless. I mean, his quote is like, "It's sort of heartbreaking when your partner turns on you. Over the past 15 years, I have sold millions of dollars worth of books on Amazon, which means I have made millions of dollars for Amazon. I would have thought I was one of their best assets. I thought we were partners in a business that has done well. This seems an odd way to treat someone who has made you millions of dollars." It's like, what? Did you think you were pals, besties? Were you trading text messages? It's just so strange. He's supposed to be this smart guy who analyzes all these things and can spot trends, and he's sort of bemused that a massive corporation is behaving like a massive corporation.
Yeah, maybe he should ask Tom Cruise how Paramount treated him after making them billions, not millions, billions of dollars. Tom, the door, when you open it, it opens out, okay? And can you close it behind you on your way out? Thank you. Goodbye.
But one thing Gladwell is right on is about the fact that this is not an equal battle. The publishing industry feels beleaguered. They feel like this is Amazon trying to drive everybody else out of business. Because when you sell books below cost, the indies can't compete. Barnes & Noble can't compete. No one can compete. And that huge ecosystem of thousands of stores and thousands of passionate book lovers will be gone. And the only place you can buy your book is Amazon. And that's why when Malcolm Gladwell was asked, he said, "No, this is not about Goliath versus Goliath. Yes, Hachette is part of a $10 billion multinational company, but in this battle, the person with the power is Amazon."
Yeah, remember, if content is king, distribution is God. So, you also had James Patterson, very popular author, who I've interviewed in the past, actually. Incredibly nice. I interviewed him when he was still working at an advertising agency. He was the head of an advertising agency, and he was writing on the side. And I thought, wow, I wish I could have an incredibly successful career in one field. And, just as a hobby, be a best-selling...
Well, that's what John Grisham did. That's what everybody else did. They did their day job and woke up at 5 a.m. You just got to burn the midnight oil, Sperling.
Wait, oil? Oil? No, yeah. No. I am that is not green at all, and I'm trying to have a light carbon footprint.
Well, James Patterson has been very vocal. A lot of authors are becoming increasingly vocal. They know this is not about Hachette versus Amazon. They know this is not about one fight between multinationals. Slate magazine tried to argue that this is actually about ebooks and how much more profitable they are for the publisher, which is absolutely true. They are more profitable. We've seen sales sometimes go down, but profits go up because you make more money per ebook. And in fact, not only do you make more money overall, but because they've screwed authors on the royalties, they make a lot more money on ebooks. And they HarperCollins themselves said, "Hey, when we've got a $28 hardcover, we get $5.67 and the author gets $4.20. When we sell a $15 ebook on the agency model, we get $7.87. That's $2 more, almost like 40% more. And the author gets $2.62, which is about $2 less, $1.60 less. So they themselves confess that their profit margins are better. But that's not the battle between Amazon and HarperCollins. Amazon wants more money, but it's not because they're like, "Oh, you're making more margin than your authors." No, they just want more money, period.
Well, certainly, you cover all... Well, I guess you don't really cover this type of... you don't cover the industry, per se, on Book Filter, but you do cover what books we should be reading.
I had a lot of meetings about Book Filter. We're getting ready to launch it officially. It's still in beta mode. That's exciting. But, I will be writing about the BEA on Huffington Post. As soon as I pull over from the side of the road with enough time to type, I'm going to do that tomorrow, I think. But one of the funny, ironic final things is that Amazon, of course, had some top picks for June, like they do every month. And two of their biggest top picks overall are from Hachette. So they're like, "Buy The Fever by Megan Abbott," except you can't. Yeah. "And Buy The Farm by Tom Rob Smith," except you can't. So that's kind of amusing.
Well, those are some of the big books that will be, I guess, released in June. But June also marks every year here in the U.S., North America, we have the Tony Awards, which honor the best and brightest on Broadway over the past year. So I guess... what's going to be happening on the Tony Awards? They're this Sunday, June 8th.
That's right. It's the Sunday coming up, probably, depending on when you listen to this podcast. But it's a big show, of course, a lot of performances. The only awards that really make you money are Best Musical and Best Revival of a Musical. Maybe sometimes Best Play, but this year that's probably not a factor. So that's really where the money's at. So beyond those two awards, where shows can really make impression, gain a lot, is by their performance. So what really matters, just like the Grammys, is who performs and who puts on a good show. So you're going to see, of course, Hugh Jackman will be the host, and Neil Patrick Harris is going to perform. Idina Menzel is going to perform for her show, If Then. Alan Cumming will perform a piece from Cabaret. And this has happened before, but it's a little unusual. Sting will be performing a song from a show that hasn't even opened yet.
Wow. So now we should mention that these performances are so coveted and they work so well as marketing that the shows actually have to pay to be a part of the Tonys. You don't just get picked or selected to be a part of the Tonys. You actually have to pony up some dough to get a good slot on the Tonys.
No, you do not pay in order to, you do not get to buy a slot. You are given a slot and then you happily help defray the expenses of mounting the slot. So, no, it is not a money-making venture, nor can you pay an X amount of dollars and secure a slot. They decide who gets to perform, and then you happily help defray the cost. It's just to keep the Tonys from becoming ridiculously expensive to mount. Because when you're talking about moving a scene from a show and mounting it one time only in a different venue, that's a very complex venture. You're going to be using the people that are already working on your show, so you've got contracts with them. They've all got that worked out usually in advance. If it goes to the Tonys, what will we charge to reduplicate this in another venue and space? You know, it's complicated, it's expensive, and each show is thrilled and happy to do it. But it's not about, like, making money.
Well,
it's
when
not
I, like- I talked to somebody from CBS, which I believe aired these. What network does the Tonys this year?
It's CBS. It doesn't move around.
Okay. Well, you
know, it's not like the Emmys.
When I was talking to one of the executives, they implied to me that they don't make a lot of money off of it, but they still make money from it. They still basically, you know, it's one of the things that helps them offset the cost, if not make money on the Tonys each year.
Right. The Tonys are not a big high audience gathering thing, but it's a great demo.
Yeah.
You know, it's well educated, well off people.
Well, and certainly, I guess Neil Patrick Harris opened the Tonys with a bang last year, and he's going to be performing because he's in Hedwig and the Angry Inch this year.
That's right. And of course, that show is up for Best Revival. But even shows that aren't nominated get to have a shot at performing. You'll see Bullets Over Broadway and Rocky, both of which need every bump they can get from an appearance on the Tony Awards. So, you know, watch those performances, and even don't worry about who wins and who doesn't win, because that probably doesn't matter except for the big two, the Best Musical and Best Revival. What really matters is who puts on a good show.
For instance, who won Best Performance by a Leading Actress in a Play 4 years ago in 2008?
Well, if you listed them, I could probably tell you.
I have no idea, actually, and I don't think anybody in our audience would. In fact, I bet you there are some Broadway people who follow Broadway day in, day out that would kind of be hard-pressed to name the names, although Scarlett Johansson won at some point in there. And I think,
well, it's not, you know, that you're making it sound like...
it's not important.
It's trivia. You turn it into trivia, you know. That's not the point. You know, the fact that you cannot name off the top of a hat who won what in 2008 or 2010 or 2012, you know, that's not really the point of it. But in 2010, it was Viola Davis for Fences. She won Best Actress.
Ah, okay.
Facing off against Valerie Harper, Linda Lavin, Laura Linney, and Jan Maxwell. And I think of those, she actually deserved it. The Linda Lavin was very good, too.
Well, I wonder if the Tonys are broadcast in other countries. I would imagine that they probably are, and how much they actually matter in other countries when those productions actually make it to, say, the UK or to Paris or to Berlin.
Well, only the biggest and biggest of shows actually travel overseas. I doubt it's a big, I'm sure it's not a big ratings draw. It doesn't even draw much here.
Well, I think, what, 40 million people watched it last year?
No, God, no. They would kill for 40 million. You kidding me?
Well, you're
not,
saying...
Not a patch on that. Oh, my God, no. They're not even the number one show of the week. No, nowhere near like 40 million. I don't know what the ratings are, but they would kiss the ground if they got that sort of rating.
7.24 million people.
So
I was off by a factor of a lot.
Five. So it's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying, looking forward. This is the most suspenseful year in ages. I know Neil Patrick Harris will win Best Actor in a Musical. Other than that, really, it's a wide open race. There's a lot of really tight categories. It's the most fun Tonys I can remember.
Well, now, do you think that he's going to win Best Actor because there's a lot of love for Neil Patrick Harris on Broadway?
Well, you know, it's his first show that he's starting. You know, he hasn't had a huge try. He's got a lot of love for Broadway, and he's hosted the Tonys, and he was in Assassins, the Stephen Sondheim musical, and he's done some events. But this is his first show that he's headlined. He doesn't have a big track record. Hugh Jackman has a bigger track record on Broadway than he does.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So this is, well, he doesn't have that many either. He just has like two shows, three shows. It's just that, you know, he's a big fixture. He's been big promoter abroad, but no, he doesn't win it because they like him. He wins it because he got rave reviews and, you know, he's the it guy of the moment.
Well, you know, I think I've told this story before, but back in 2004, I was staying in New York at the Paramount Hotel across
the... Did you date Neil Patrick Harris?
No. This has to do with Hugh Jackman. It has nothing to do
with... Did you date Hugh Jackman?
No. I was at the Paramount Hotel across the street from the back door of the theater in which Hugh Jackman was performing The Boy from Oz. And every night between midnight and 1 a.m., he would come out the backstage door and there would be screams. Just blood-curdling screams that would wake me up as he exited the theater and tried to make it into his, Lincoln Town Car that was waiting.
I'm sure he signed playbills and chatted for a minute and took pictures as he went.
He was out there for hours. I was shocked. Every single night he would do it for at least an hour.
Well, that's a big deal. It's nice of him to take the time to share with the fans and give him a little extra flesh.
Oh, I see. If that's a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, I don't know what to say about it. It doesn't really seem possible, but late night talk shows just became more male and more white. We got Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, Craig Ferguson, Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and David Letterman already there. So how is that even possible? Well, it's possible because Late Night will definitely lose Chelsea Handler, whose show is ending on E! In August. And now so too will a late night talker hosted by Arsenio Hall. That's ending because Hall's show was just renewed, but now it has just as quickly been canceled.
Or unrenewed, perhaps.
Unrenewed, yes. This is a much nicer phrase than canceled. The studio behind it had second thoughts when the station's carrying Arsenio, which was the name of the show, they virtually all downgraded its time slot. A possible hit thus becomes a sinking ship, and they called it a day. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, I was a little surprised it even got renewed for a second season. It didn't seem to have a lot of traction, though it's hard sometimes to get figures on late night television. From what I could gather, it didn't seem to be setting the house on fire. It was more of a surprise that they renewed it. But, you know, why would you renew it without knowing where the people were going to put it in their time slot? It seems sort of badly handled. Let's put it that way. Maybe they were trying to show faith and encourage the people to keep it in its time
slot.
That's
exactly
right. Fell apart. Yeah, but you rarely see something like this where it gets renewed second season and then a week or two later, like, oh, never mind. That doesn't happen much.
Yeah. Well,
normally they know what's going on.
My question is, what in the world am I going to say to him now when we're at the gym together?
Can't you do the dog pound thing still?
Well, I guess maybe.
All right.
Maybe I can say, hey, you know, if you're looking for some music to work out to, you should subscribe to Amazon Prime. Because Amazon's plan for streaming music service are becoming clearer now. It will be a service for Amazon Prime members, at least those Prime members who haven't canceled their subscription, angry that they couldn't get J.K. Rowling's new mystery from Hachette overnighted to them. In any case, the on-demand service will offer some, you know, catalog and newish tunes, newish in parentheses, you know, air quotes, if you will. They're songs that are at least 6 months old. There's no word yet on how much music will be available, but it's believed people will have a strictly limited number of plays for each song. So it's one of those, like, you know, they're trying to limit their cost here.
They want you to buy.
Right.
They want it to be a sampling streaming service, not a substitute for buying. So their idea is, look, we'll just go 6 months back. We won't show new stuff, and they can play it a couple times, but then they got to buy it. So they can sample it, and then they buy it.
Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal that just the fact that we're getting little tidbits of information and that's becoming news shows you how powerful and scared people are about Amazon. You know, they still haven't announced it. We still don't know what the details are, but we're getting hints and rumors and things. And every little bit is like, oh, what are they doing? What are they doing? Because they're a big mover. They're a big player. And what they do is going to have a ripple effect on all these other companies.
Well, it hasn't had a ripple effect on, video. Oh, I guess it has actually begun to have a bit of a ripple effect on streaming media. On streaming video, I should say.
Uh-huh.
VOD. Streaming VOD.
I mean, I don't know. Has that an effect? I don't know.
I guess
just in their player and everything. They've got original content, just like others. You know. Yeah.
Good point. Well, you know, sometimes it seems like Harvey Weinstein should be called Rumpelstiltskin. You know, since he can spin controversy into gold just as quickly as that fabled character did. The same with Straw. The latest example: Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. That comes out in August, and the Weinsteins whipped up a sexy poster featuring Ava Green in a flimsy white dress that was a little too sheer and revealing for the MPAA's liking, the MPAA being the Motion Picture Association of America.
Do we have a photo? Do we have a photo on the website? Do we have the image on the website?
Well, you can go to celluloidjunkie.com, and I wrote a post about it, and believe me, there was some discussion about whether we could actually post that photo or whether we had to crop it. We decided to post the entire poster.
Really?
No pun intended.
Why would you show a cropped image?
That was kind of the point. Well, naturally, the Weinstein Company immediately kind of leaked the image of the poster all over the internet into a couple of, page six over at the New York Post. They basically said, come see the scandalous poster of the luscious Ava Green that the MPAA censored. The poster too hot to display in movie theaters. Download the image today and post it on your Twitter feed and share it with your friends. Step right up. There's one born every minute. Sin City 2 comes out August 22nd. If any Ava Green fans want to mark their calendars. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, and I would like to add that I'm taking off my coonskin cap because I'm in a car, in a parking lot, under the sun, and I have to have the AC off because you'd hear the whole whining noise, so I'm melting in this car.
Well, you know, instead we just hear the semis going back and forth.
You hear the semis and the drip of my sweat onto my laptop, onto your laptop, I should say.
Well, in any case, this was very interesting. It was a reminder to me about the MPAA's Advertising Administration, which reviews 60,000 pieces of marketing material for every film that is rated.
Yikes.
Yeah. Can you believe that? What a job. You know, here we're skipping over ads, and there's actually somebody paid to watch all of them. Now, NBC loves the American football. We've talked about this in the past, Michael. Their number one show is Sunday Night Football, and while one day of programming, known as the Super Bowl, can't turn an entire season around, it sure does help. I guess 111 million Super Bowl viewers can't really be wrong. They're certainly worth a chunk of change. NBC is charging a record $4.5 million for a 30-second spot during the 2015 Gridiron Classic. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal, and I'm sure this record will stand till at least 2016.
Yes, we've got a good 18 months on this record. Now, Queen is back.
That Queen?
Yeah.
You don't mean the Queen, like, hello?
Yes, that Queen. Well, sort of. The band is touring with Adam Lambert of American Idol and having fun doing it. Sales are strong, so of course people immediately wonder if, you know, the band would record some new music with Adam Lambert under the Queen moniker. Hold your horses, everybody, because the late Freddie Mercury isn't done quite yet. And a move already made by everyone from the Beatles to Michael Jackson, the band is taking some of Mercury's unused vocals, beefing up the backing tracks, and releasing some new songs. Probably part of a new compilation, frankly. And for those in the UK, there's talk of a sequel to their West End musical, We Will Rock You. Yes, indeed. I guess it ran for 12 years and closed just a couple days ago, May 31st. The show played around the world, but rarely for more than a year or two, except in Germany, where it was a substantial hit. In the US, it toured briefly and played Vegas before sputtering out, but 12 years in London is a lot of pounds, and I mean that in the financial sense. So the original creative team is, you know, they're trying to figure out what they do next. They're cooking up a sequel. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You're recycling vocals from a beloved late artist. You're making a sequel to a show that was a massive hit that was barely a show anyway. All you got to do is get another 20 Queen songs. Though I don't think there are another 20 Queen songs that are as iconic as the ones they already used. So I'm not quite sure that's a great idea, though. You know, they made a lot of money, so I guess it's hard to resist.
I guess so.
By the way, speaking of recycling the vocals of late dead beloved artists, I just listened to the Michael Jackson album Escape.
And that's with, boy, a capital X, Escape.
Escape. And it sounds exactly like the stuff that was in the trash bin that was not good enough to make it, that they used and slapped on some new stuff. You know, it's
right.
Tiresome. The only thing I would say, it points out what a great artist he was as far as the producing. Of course, Quincy Jones and a lot of top producers worked on his albums. But you can immediately tell that these backing tracks are not up to snuff and not what he would have done. Even though they had the best producers in the world working on this, you know, it clearly sounds like some slapped on stuff afterthought, you know, just not up to standard.
Yeah. Well, and that's why on all those contracts, you got to write what stays in the garbage can, you know, during the first run, it stays there after I'm gone. But, you know, now a couple weeks ago, we talked about, you know, Beats Music being acquired by Apple. But that was a rumor at the time. And it seems that Apple...
$3 billion rumor.
$3.7 billion. Well, I guess maybe the leak cost them $700 million. Who knows? But the Apple finally did announce that they are buying Beats Music for about $3 billion. And do they care about the massively successful Beats headphones line, which has raked in massive amounts of cash and is a proven winner? No, they don't, actually, not really. Do they care about the streaming music service Beats just launched, a limping out-of-the-gate service that nabbed a weak 111,000 subscribers? Do they care about that? Why, actually, yes, they do. The music subscription service was the first thing Apple mentioned when announcing the acquisition. Were the headphones number two? Not really, no. That was artist Dr. Dre and producer Jimmy Iovine, both of whom will lend their golden ears and industry connections to helping Apple conceive of musical offerings for the future. Does this mean we have to wait even longer for Dre's long gestating final album Detox, which has been in the works for, 14 years, actually, and counting. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. We knew it was going to happen. We were basically right about what and why. It's kind of shocking, though. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, the headphones, too.
Yeah, well, you know, it just goes to show you that music is a lot harder than everybody thought. Even Apple kind of had a bit of a rough time trying to start a streaming service. But it also kind of worries me that, gee, I guess, you know, the group, Apple, that the company that was an innovator is now buying innovation. They're not creating innovation.
Well, they're arguing that Jimmy Iovine is an Apple-like genius who can spin off creative ideas and other people will put them out. And I don't know where he's been this creative genius. You know, he has great taste in artists and he's had a huge success as a record producer, but like this headphones thing is the only thing he's done entrepreneurially as far as I know. So I don't know why he's suddenly the guru and savant, but they're arguing, oh no, he's part of our, he's got our DNA in him and he's gonna be great. But you're paying a lot of money to get, you couldn't pay them $10 million each to come hang out and offer their services. Dre, by the way, is worth $550 million, which is probably 550 million reasons why he's not that aggressively working on his solo album.
Right. Well, and you know who wasn't mentioned a lot during this whole acquisition was Ian Rogers, who they brought on from Topspin Media to actually run Beats Music. So that was kind of interesting.
Oh, is he going to be out of the loop? He's not making the transition?
I don't know. We'll find out.
I hope he has a good contract.
Yeah, well, speaking of contracts and people who are out of the loop, Kevin Reilly has been shown the door by Fox.
Bye-bye.
The one-time head of Fox TV was riding high when American Idol dominated the airwaves, but now the talent competition series has fallen hard, and once lucrative Glee is limping to a final or finale, and potential future franchises like Kevin Bacon's The Following have slumped after a promising first year, critical faves like The Mindy Project and Brooklyn Nine-Nine look more like Reilly's attempts to recreate NBC's beloved but unwatched lineup of sitcoms on Thursday for the past few years, rather than the next Malcolm in the Middle. And when ratings are way down and you have no good new hits to point to, well, again, much like Mr. Cruz was told, the door opens outward. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. These things happen all the time. He will land somewhere wonderfully well. And the only fun part about this is watching to see the shows that he helped launch for the coming fall season to see which ones click. You know, he gets shown the door. I'll bet you Gotham, the Batman prequel starring Benjamin McKenzie from The O.C. and Southland. I bet that's really touted to do well. That could be a game changer for Fox. And of course, he'll already be gone. Just like Susan Line was at ABC right before they launched the shows. She you know, she had 1 year and they kicked her out. And then the shows that she helped get on the air, including Lost and Desperate Housewives, went on the air.
Yeah, well, you know, that's always the way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, people love Kevin Reilly. At least the press loves Kevin Reilly because he was always very candid with them. So we'll see where he lands.
We like good quote.
Yes. Well, director Roland Emmerich is very, very, very happy. His name hasn't been dragged into the mud by the rape and underage sex scandal allegations that have rocked director Bryan Singer and others in Hollywood, even though he has reportedly been part of that crowd over the years. And
by that crowd, we mean just Bryan Singer. And, you know, he's part of gay Hollywood. He's a very visible gay person. And I know he's been to some of the their big parties, none of which are alleged to have been centers
been
of
to
crime
some of
or
them.
Illicitness.
If you read.
And hosted them. Yeah.
He's hosted them. Yeah.
Yeah. He's been definitely part. We don't want to. You know, link him to the crowd as in the people who have been, though I believe he is linked, but, you know, we don't want to say definitely to the people that have been charged as sex, you know, sex, you know, it's ugly, and he's all definitely in the mix. So the fact that he doesn't get mentioned a lot is pretty lucky. I mean, you look at Bryan Singer, he's got the biggest movie in America practically right now, and he's sort of invisible.
That's right. Well, instead, Mr. Emmerich is focusing on his biggest franchises. First, Emmerich is launching two sequels to Independence Day, starting with Independence Day Forever, or ID Part 1, depending on the source.
Which will have a gay character, by the way, a prominent gay character hoping to save the world.
Well, okay, you know.
Well, yeah.
Bill Pullman is coming back, but Will Smith is now too expensive, per Emmerich. And that's what he says, and he is not returning. Those will be followed by a trilogy of films set in the Stargate universe. And before all of that, he's currently making Stonewall, his gay rights drama that is Emmerich's bid to make his best-reviewed film since Mel Gibson's The Patriot. Is this all a big deal or a big whoop, or can we just move right along?
Well, it's a big whoop. Maybe he's making Stonewall to make up for helping Mel Gibson have one of his best movies of his career. But, you know, they're always making sequels. I mean, they just announced My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Ugh.
Like, have we been waiting for a sequel to that from Nia Vardalos? On the other hand, I have to say she had a funny joke. She said, of course, a few jaded folks in the press corps will claim I ran out of money or just want to kiss John Corbett again. One of these things is true.
Yeah, she's actually very funny. You know, she's basically saying, look, I'm a mother now, and so, you know, there's some new chapters, and I could, you know, continue the family story. Which is probably true. She's probably best known for doing autobiographical work, so why not? Why you have to reference it to My Big Fat Greek Wedding is beyond me.
It would be silly not to.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I remember actually interviewing Mel Gibson and Roland Emmerich for The Patriot, and Mel Gibson, throughout the entire interview, he chain-smoked. The entire time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was, you know, by the end of that interview, I think I was, you know, wheezing out the door. Now, speaking of sequels and spinoffs, director James Cameron and Cirque du Soleil are working together on a stage show. Cirque loves poorly written New Ageist odes to the natural world and fantastical creatures and all that stuff. And, you know, James Cameron made Avatar. So if you're wondering whether their project will be linked to Pandora, well, you haven't been paying much attention to the ways of Hollywood and Cirque, which will add this show to their portfolio, bulging with shows built around the Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis, and the like. If you're intrigued, you won't have to wait long. The stage show is set to come out in late 2015, a solid year before the first Avatar sequel is set to debut in December of 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, obviously. It's an extension of the franchise. It's a natural pairing, frankly. I mean, their stage shows have a Pandora-like vibe all the time. Half the shows feel like they're underwater or in some sylvan paradise. So, you know, I guess it makes sense.
In a special effect worthy of the greats in Hollywood history, the visual effect industry is becoming invisible in Los Angeles. Rhythm and Hues went bankrupt, Digital Domain pulled up stakes and relocated to Vancouver, Canada, and now Sony Imageworks is doing the exact same thing, heading to Vancouver, Canada. They employed about 270 people in Culver City, but no more. Some of them will likely pull up stakes and relocate, but the best will be stuck in a town that doesn't have many visual effects jobs left. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is it going to affect the quality of the effects? Is it going to mean, you know, obviously it's a big deal for the people involved personally. That's awful. But, you know, all this stuff has gone overseas at least it's Vancouver. It's not the other side of the world, I guess. But, gee, you know, is this going to really, is there not the infrastructure anymore? Is the infrastructure just moved? Is it important to be nearby or can you be on the moon and do the visual effects work? You know better than I, Sperling.
Well, you can be anywhere, in fact. So it's really a matter of there's a whole bunch of people who are talented and trained in a craft living in a specific area with a specific infrastructure. That infrastructure now is spread across the world, and those people will have to spread across the world as well. The question is, will there be jobs for them, or is this just a downsizing of that particular industry because, you know, technology allows for it?
So are they just saving money on salaries? Or, I mean, that's why they're moving overseas, right? It's cheaper to live there and work there, right?
Right. It's, yeah cheaper.
So, but I mean, can you keep cutting dimes that way?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Is there no advantage to having people nearby? Is there no advantage to having a thriving community of people who are near the producers and the directors and the actors and the talent? You know, is there no advantage to that synergy where everybody's in the same space? Because that's what you hear a lot about these days.
Well, I think there is. And you can just ask Peter Jackson, who did not place Weta in like Indonesia. He placed it in New Zealand, where he was making the Hobbit films.
Where there was no infrastructure before. He built it from the ground up, practically.
That's right, yes.
All right, well, let's move on to Inside Baseball.
Well, I guess, Michael, if we're going to move on to Inside Baseball, we should explain that this is the segment where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, as promised, we're going to have Anthony Kaufman, a film journalist and critic whose writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Village Voice, Slate. You contribute, Anthony, regularly to Variety, IndieWire, The Wall Street Journal Online, and The Utney Reader. Your work is it's all over the place. It's prolific. Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Sure, happy to be here.
Well, now, you wrote an excellent piece for IndieWire about how foreign language films are languishing at the U.S. box office. It was sparked by a piece in Variety written by film critic Scott Fondas, who was saying U.S. audiences are more comfortable with subtitles, more comfortable than ever before. And I guess you can think of the subtitles in movies like Inglourious Basterds or Passion of the Christ, Slumdog Millionaire, and TV shows like 24 or even Lost at times. And that's true. But as you point out, just because U.S. audiences are comfortable with subtitles, it doesn't necessarily mean they're actually going to see foreign language films. Why is that?
Well, I don't think that they are necessarily comfortable with subtitles. I mean, they might bear subtitles in a Quentin Tarantino film. They might, you know, sort of forget the fact that the subtitles are such a prominent part of, you know, The Passion of the Christ. They're seeing those movies, despite the subtitles. So that's one issue that, you know, we need to sort of get right out of the way.
Well, what I loved about this story was you did a story in IndieWire about this, and you would raise the point. I'd say, well, what about? And then the next thing you'd address that. And they go, well, yeah, but then there's, and then you would address that. So it was a very thorough piece where you talked about things like what the actual box office is, rather than just saying you have the impression that subtitle films are more popular than ever or people are happier with them. And you talked about, you know, the lowering of independent studios that are touting foreign language films. You've got, foreign language films were never a strong force on video on demand. Netflix is reducing their catalog of foreign language films, cable video on demand. It is all these different areas and reasons why foreign language films are perhaps not as popular as he'd like to believe. Let's start with the box office. You looked at the top five foreign language films and what they earned last year, and that was about $15 million. And I guess looking at the top five is good because most foreign language films never break, you know, half a million. So if you get the top five, you're getting most of the box office right there, aren't you?
Right. That's right. I mean, I think it's obviously you can spin the numbers in many different ways, but you know, if you take the top five, sort of skim the cream of the crop off, you know, you can see there is a steady decline in the last 6 or 7 years, you know, where it's maybe at its highest, you know, after Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And there's like, if you know, I made a bar graph with the story, although it wasn't published, but you see a steady decline year after year. You know, there's a little, there's 1 or 2 years in the last 7 years where it was particularly bad. But for the most part, it's a steady decline from about 35 million to around, yeah, like you said, 15 or 16 million last year. So
now why would it decline if that implies people were more comfortable with it? And now is it just the crop of films, or what's making them avoid them more today than they were 10 years ago?
Well, there's obviously lots of possible reasons. I mean, one is that the studios who were releasing the films so aggressively are no longer doing so. So just marketing budgets are lower, and therefore the box office associated with the films is lower. Another reason is that maybe the films themselves coming out of foreign countries are not catered so specifically to, you know, break out the U.S. box office. I don't know if I buy that one. Another reason is that, you know, the art house audience is getting older and they're staying at home.
Wow. Well, I guess I now feel very old because I realize I have not seen a foreign film that I've paid for. You know, I've gone to screenings certainly, and I've watched a lot of them at home, though. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And as the article points out, unfortunately, as more and more art house viewers do go online, they are not necessarily watching those foreign language films. Foreign language films have never been really particularly hot online, unless they're somehow scandalous or very sexy, then VOD numbers are fairly good for something like Blue is the Warmest Color. I'm sure with the two lesbians on the, you know, in the picture, it's probably doing fine on VOD on the new distribution platforms. But, you know, some less salacious foreign film by, you know, one of our great world auteurs, they're not picking up the slack on VOD.
So foreign language films need more lesbians.
That might help.
Well, you know, I actually wanted to, in Cannes, tell Kashish, hey, you know, here your film is known, this was last year in 2013, your film is known here as the 3-hour lesbian movie. My suggestion is change the title to the 3-hour lesbian movie when it hits the U.S. You'll do better. But
well, the 2-hour lesbian movie. Now that would have been...
Absolutely. That's kind of depressing, though, to say that video on demand is not helping more small foreign films reach a wider audience. You would think, oh, but out there, they'll be really possible. But in fact, they'd rather show 100 viewings of Tommy Boy than make a foreign language film available because they figure they'll get more money out of it. And that continues on into other areas. You point out that fewer foreign language films are probably getting into the movie theaters because it's so much cheaper to make a movie and so much cheaper to get it on video on demand in these other places. There's more of a demand to get them with some nominal theatrical showing, which means all those slots at IFC and the Angelica Cinemas and the other independent art houses are being taken up by English language films that in the past probably would have just played Sundance and disappeared onto VHS.
I think so. And I think, I mean, that's the real scary part. Is we're talking about, you know, the future of film viewing, where you know, viewers are going. And if foreign language films are being squeezed out in that area, then I just don't see a way that they're going to break through. I mean, I think that to me is the as a, you know, as a lover of foreign language films, that to me is the scary part. If they're not getting the kind of play that other independent films are getting on these alternative platforms, then they really are in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I guess coming back from Cannes this year, I was so excited that I thought, wow, you know, world cinema is really doing well. And, you know, there's so many great movies being made all over the world now, and they're going to be making their way into the U.S. And we're all going to be seeing movies like Leviathan or like the Dolan movie Mommy. We're going to be seeing these movies. And even though they're not in English, you know, they'll really spread wide and far. I read your piece and I just wanted to cry.
Well, I did time the piece for Cannes.
Yes, so, I noticed.
You know, yeah. You would feel that way. I mean, you know, who's to, you know, lots of people, particularly Sony Pictures Classics, who picked up a lot of those films, they will tell you, you know, it's just cyclical. We'll see films bouncing back. Although Tom Bernard, the head of Sony Pictures Classics, recently, you know, and I think he's quoted in that story, you know, said to me that the way that the foreign language film Oscars have shifted their regulations and their rules has made him even more wary of distributing foreign language films because it's harder for certain foreign language films to make it to the top five nominees.
Right. So I guess technically right now it used to be that it was a select group that would be able to vote for best foreign language film. And now the entire Academy can vote. And so he's saying now it's just going to be a popularity contest rather than selecting films that are actually some of the best of the year.
That's right. So something like Leviathan, a Russian film, you know, by a, you know, sort of more avant-garde filmmaker, right? It just doesn't have a chance with the broad Academy. So it gives a company like Sony Pictures Classics less incentive to really push it because it's not an Academy film like Kolya or, you know, anything with a little kid.
Though obviously Leviathan would never have been nominated by Russia as their official foreign language film.
Good point.
Putin was not about to let Leviathan be the movie that represents his country.
Good point.
But Sony Pictures Classics does have one of the best reviewed films of the year. It's called The Lunchbox. It's a charming film from India. And at that point, they'd made about $2.7 million. They're up to $4 million, which is a good amount for a foreign language film. But he says if times were different, he could have made $9 million with that movie.
I believe it. And I think everyone thought that movie was going to break out big. But as he says, without the extra push of an Oscar nomination, It just didn't have the legs.
And he in this case is Tom Bernard, the head of Sony Picture Classics. And I guess nobody is really paying attention to the shortlist when it comes to the foreign language Oscars, are they? They're not really they really just care about the last five rather than it gets whittled down from like 70 to then like 35 and then from 35, you know, it just keeps getting winnowed down. Nobody's really paying attention to any of those other movies, are they?
Right. And I think what they're really paying attention to is the winner. You know, that's Academy Award winner, you know, of Best Foreign Language Film. And that's the movie that will go from, you know, just playing on Netflix to being at Walmart, you know, which makes all the difference in the world to these companies.
One other factor is that Netflix, according to some people, this is anecdotal, but this is the impression of Richard Lorber of Kino Lorber. He says that Netflix is not keeping the deep catalog on foreign films or new releases that they used to.
That's right.
And you think they'd have nothing to lose.
Well, again, Netflix, you know, started out with a business model, you know, that was the long tail. You know, it was let's just have lots of everything. But now, like any big company, they're going towards the dollars are, and the dollars are not in, you know, small foreign language films. They're in TV. You know, look where Netflix is putting their money. You know, new original series. It's not the same kind of model that they once had. I don't think it's necessarily anecdotal. I heard from lots of different smaller companies who have seen their films disappear from Netflix.
Well, we actually on episode 214 had Anita Elbersey of the Hollywood Reporter. Listen to me. She's from Harvard. She wrote this book called Blockbusters. Which focuses specifically on what you're saying, that Netflix's idea of the long tail is really flawed and that they should be focusing on blockbusters. Effectively, you're saying that's exactly what they're winding up doing.
And TV. Yep.
And TV, yes.
Is there any good news in television? Because we are seeing some foreign films, because there are so many cable channels and online services that need content that they can tout. So we're seeing some shows like the French version of The Return and the Danish drama Borgen are popping up and getting a little traction and appearance on American TV. Is that a possible sign of the future of some good news?
Right. That was my attempt at ending my story with some positive on a positive note, I guess. I personally am not that familiar with these shows, but they are subtitled. You know, they are about non-US experience, and people do seem to be watching those shows in greater numbers. The ratings apparently are good. They're being tapped for remakes, and so it does seem like these series, in the same way that, you know, people are binge viewing on you know, lots of other stuff, HBO productions, you know, maybe that is the future of kind of foreign language entertainment in the U.S.
Well, let me ask. I mean, you know, maybe these movies aren't doing well on VOD or
anywhere
or anywhere, I guess. But really, in the home, maybe they're not doing well because the television is smaller. So thus the subtitles will be smaller and it's just a pain to read. Is that part of the problem, do you think?
I have heard that from distributors. I've heard that, like, as maybe cliche or as silly as that sounds, I've heard that exact thing from more than one or two individuals in the business. They say people don't want to read subtitles on their TVs.
Even today, that seems weird with the TV screens are so big. But Peter Goldwyn is certainly a little dour. He thinks foreign language films are, in fact, the canary in the coal mine. He says if you look at what's happening to them, this may be where the whole industry is headed down the road. What does he mean?
Yeah, I mean, the canary in the coal mine was my interpretation of his suggestion, right? If things continue to go really away from the long tail model and more towards the blockbuster model, foreign language films won't be the first to start disappearing. You know, won't be the only type of film disappearing.
Forget indie films. Forget art films. Forget English language art films.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as someone told me once, another insider reporting for a different story, as soon as Hollywood jumps on the day and date model, right, and you can get, you know, the new Tom Cruise movie on your TV, you know, within a week of its opening in theaters, who do you think's going to be seeing some little indie, you know, American indie online or on their TVs when they can see the new you know, big blockbuster movie?
Well, I guess
so. As soon as Hollywood jumps on this, the new digital bandwagon, indie films are going to be crushed.
Well, it's kind of like Cannes in a way. We just mentioned Cannes. It's you know, you go to Cannes and everybody shows up for the Nicole Kidman movie, and then Leviathan you could walk and waltz right into.
Well, that's bizarre since that's such a big film for the festival. But don't we see a track record when people do have a curated option and they're given an equal choice and you go to the box office of a theater, there is the Tom Cruise movie. But then when there's 10 or 20 screens, there are smaller films and sometimes are films, and they choose them when they're given the option, when they're given the advantage, when they're given the visibility that other films are given. It's when they disappear that you have to worry, because they don't even have a chance of being seen.
I think, and that's the scary thing about the foreign language films. They're not getting the screen space, you know, because not only is the Tom Cruise movie taking 20 movies, you know, not only are Fox Searchlight and the Weinstein Company, you know, taking up a bunch of screens with their movies, not only are all the VOD companies, doing these day and date releases, you know, all those films are taking up those screens. Therefore, there's just very little space for that foreign language art house film.
Well, now I wonder, in reverse, so English language films heading overseas to France, Germany, Japan, South Korea, I wonder if there's a study that's been done that says, well, gee, more people are taking the dub or going to see the dubbed version of those films over the subtitled version, and thus maybe it's just something in human nature where we just don't want to be reading while we're watching a movie.
It's usually humans. Not an option, right? It's culturally either they offer dub or they don't offer dub, right?
I don't know. I think, yes. And well, yeah, you get version original and then you get the dub version. I don't know, but I don't know whether one is more popular than the other. I think in France, dub versions don't. I don't know. I could be totally wrong with this, but I seem to remember like reading something about dub versions not doing well in France. But Italy, you know, Italy, it's all dubbed. You don't really have an option. And Germany, I think it's similar, right? You don't even have a subtitled option often.
Right. And in Mexico, you have a subtitled option. So as you say, an original version, an OV, and a dubbed version, but only on kids' movies. Most of the time, it's the OV, unless it's for children.
Dios mío. Well, speaking of Mexico, your box office figures from the last few years do not include movies like Instructions Not Included, which you decided was in a different category of actually just appealing to that core audience rather than being a crossover film.
And that's a good point. I was just going to seg that way myself. I think this is an interesting story that needs to be done now, is looking at the rise of foreign language Latin, you know, Latino films and foreign language, you know, Indian films, right? Hindu language and Spanish language films in the U.S. I'll bet you'll see a converse line to the line I discussed where it was a, you know, steady decline. I bet you would see a precipitous incline in the box office sales of those films.
Well, now, some of the way those films, Instructions Not Included is a bad example, but I do know that there is a Hindi film circuit here in the U.S. where the film will show up on a Sunday and in one place in Portland and then be sent on to Cleveland for a weekend. And they only get shown once, maybe twice. And I noticed in some of the comments on the piece you wrote on IndieWire that there were some people saying, hey, you know, maybe the business model, maybe the distribution patterns need to change for some of these foreign language films. And instead of an entire week, maybe with digital projection now, we can actually have a film show maybe just on a single day or every other day, or, you know, show four or five different foreign language films throughout the week. Do you think that might help?
I think it's an interesting idea. I think, yeah, experimentation in distribution and exhibition is a good idea. I think, anything that can be done to sort of, you know, make an event out of these films, right? We do the same thing and just, you know, any non-Hollywood film, right? Somehow you need to create some anticipation and some excitement around it. You know, mini film festivals, something like that, or, you know, events in conjunction with, you know, the film, you know, food and, you know, Korean dinners and Korean films, you know, anything to create some excitement around.
Actual lesbians in the audience.
Wow. Okay. Well, on that note,
it's just a thought. I mean, you go to New York or San Francisco, they're always there, as they should be, as we should all be.
Okay. Well, certainly, Anthony Kaufman, you can be found, I guess, over at IndieWire. You have a blog there at blogs.indiewire.com/Anthony. But you're also a freelance journalist and you cover indie film for a number of outlets, including Variety, IndieWire, Wall Street Journal Online. Is there anything else we should be promoting? Like maybe your
Twitter account?
Your Twitter account, Ant Kaufman. We'll place links to all of this in the show notes, but figured we'd ask anyway.
Well, I have two books.
I have a book website.
One is forthcoming. This is something I co-authored with Ted Hope called Hope for Film.
It's on my list already. Yeah.
Okay. You could find it on Amazon. And then I have this book I edited of interviews with Steven Soderbergh. So you can link to that too. I'm currently revising it, but they don't have a website for the revision and update yet. So.
Well, so you've written two books. I now feel incredibly inadequate and unproductive.
Well, both were, you know, one was edited and the other was co-written. So I really haven't written any books.
Hope for a Film comes out on June 10th. August, so it comes August. Out a week from Tuesday.
I think it's August now.
Is it August now? Well, they have updated their Onyx feed.
check Amazon. You might, yeah, I think it's August.
Well, apparently it's not being published by Hachette.
Yeah, right.
Well, it doesn't mean there's a buy button.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks very much.
Oh, that was great of him to stop by. That was my pick. I thought that story was really well reported and really well done. I wanted to talk about it. I thought it was fascinating. The one thing I would love, though, is that, you know, he sort of cherry-picked the numbers from Box Office Mojo that were available.
Yes. And it's hard to find certain information.
I wanted to reach out to the MPAA and ask them for some stats on foreign language films from the last 10, 20 years. Like, do they have any overall stats? To know, come on, let's tell us what the whole box office is for all of them. For the last 30 years, you know, don't give us this year and that year. I'd love a more comprehensive view. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to do the legwork.
Well, and I think, you know, to Anthony's credit, I think just going back even to 2001, as he did, it's hard, especially as a journalist when you've got other commitments and other
No, that was a very well-reported story. I'm just saying this is one area I would have liked to have pursued further.
Yes. Well, it's a fascinating story. We will place a link to it in the show notes. And I do thank Anthony for joining us on today's show. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. Anywhere they aggregate podcasts, that's usually where you can find us. And we do urge you to subscribe and to rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. You can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, we should come right up. Links to all of the stories we've discussed today, including Anthony's story, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, to follow us, to like us. You can even email us, as we mentioned, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It rotates every week. This week, Michael, what is it?
It's Fess Parker. Are you Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett? MakeUpYourMind.com.
I have no idea what that means, so maybe what
Fess
you should
Parker
do.
Fess Parker played both Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. He happened to play both Wild Frontier men.
Oh, okay. I thought you were referring to the wine. I thought you were referring to the wine. Sorry.
Fess Parker, the wine?
Yes, it was in Sideways.
Oh.
Okay. The Santa Barbara Winery.
Nothing to say.
Well, on that note, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on that particular website, the name of which I can't remember, try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to his website, bookfilter.com, and see what books you should be reading. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.